Today, the first argument for the second panel is case number 58632, International Fidelity v. Municipal Court. Mr. Flynn, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Morning. Thank you. My name is Connor Flynn with Armstrong Teasdale. I'm here with my co-counsel, Tracy DiFilippo, and we represent the petitioners. I requested 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Your Honors, the real issue, I think, before the court today is, what power does a municipal court have to enter a forfeiture when a bond has already been exonerated? If you look at the record in the case, the bond was exonerated according to the minutes. And I don't think there's any dispute about that. The city stated at the hearing before the municipal court, it said, or this is Mr. Pileski with the city, he said, now certainly I can't argue with the fact that on February 26th, someone from the court entered specialty assessment fee, surety bond exonerated. So what did the city do after the bond was exonerated? They didn't seek to reinstate the bond. They instead issued a notice of forfeiture. Well, Your Honors, how can you issue a notice of forfeiture when a bond has already been exonerated? There's no legal effect to the forfeiture. And if you look at the NRS statutes, NRS 178.502 says that NRS 178.502 Section 2 says, any bond or undertaking for bail must provide that the bond or undertaking remains in effect until exonerated by the court. And NRS 178.506 says that a court can declare forfeiture if there is a breach of condition of a bond, the court shall declare forfeiture of the bail. Well, how can you declare forfeiture of a bond that's already been exonerated, Your Honors? I guess that's the question that I pose to you today.
I submit, let me pose this question to you. We have substantial jurisprudence in this state that says that minute orders are ineffectual, we do not operate on the basis of minute orders. We only operate on the basis of written orders. Why doesn't that render your argument moot?
Well, Your Honor, I can say that I've done a lot of these bond motions to exonerate. They're always granted by minute order. It's just the way things are done. And even if minute orders...
Perhaps that's true. Won't dispute your representation. But our case law is pretty substantial that this court does not operate on minute orders.
Well, Your Honor, to really answer your question, I believe if we look at the Martinez case and the Tuttle case, which are relied upon by the city, in those cases there was a similar thing where there was a docket entry or a clerical note that basically said, you know, that the bond was no longer in effect. Well, in those cases, what happened was the government moved to reinstate the bonds, and notwithstanding, or in order to relieve the effects of the clerical error or the minute order. I think that's what should have happened here. If there's a minute order that says the bond's exonerated, I don't think that the city should just come in and do a notice of forfeiture. I think what they should have to do is do some type of motion to reinstate the bond or discover or try to figure out why there has been this clerical error, if they believe it was a clerical error. But Your Honor, in this case, there isn't even any indication that this was even a clerical error. When you look at the transcript of what happened, in the minutes, what happened was the defendant failed to appear, a bench warrant was issued, and then a couple weeks later, he reappeared in court, and the bench warrant was satisfied, and the judge exonerated the bond. That's a pretty standard process, Your Honors, for exonerating a bond. There's authority under NRS 178.509 to exonerate a bond once the defendant reappears. And so, I've never seen anything in the record from the city which says that the judge actually erroneously exonerated the bond. What the city has been arguing is that, well, you know, the minutes say the bond was exonerated, and then we sent out a notice of forfeiture, and you sat on your hands and didn't do anything. And you should have filed some type of motion to confirm that the bond was exonerated, which seems a little crazy to me that we should have the burden to file a motion to confirm that a minute order says a bond has been exonerated, when I believe, according to even the case law the city relies upon, that the proper procedure would be for the city to have the burden of filing a motion to reinstate. And that's what the case law says, Your Honor.
But, counsel, this goes to the point that Justice Hardesty was raising. If we have a signed order other than that minute order, then there's something that the surety can reasonably rely upon. Just having a minute order without a signed order creates a problem for us in light of our jurisprudence.
Your Honor, and I think it's a good point, and I think, you know, I guess it gets into the way courts run bond exonerations. I've done these in district court, in justice court, in municipal court, and that is the standard protocol. In fact, the only time that
it was moving in district court, the district court rules prevail, and as per Justice Hardesty, that is the rule.
Your Honor, and I understand that, you know, minute orders may not be effectual, but then I guess the question is, does that just mean that bonds aren't exonerated then when there's a minute order that says they're exonerated? The municipal court is treating those minute orders as bond exonerations because they're not coming to our clients to seek compensation for the bonds. The minute order says that it's been exonerated. So I think if the city's been relying upon it, I think we should have every right to do so as well. And when we look at NRS 697, Your Honors, which relates to collateral, when we have the obligation to return collateral to an indemnitor, it says, NRS 697.320 says, a certified copy of the minute order from the court wherein the bail or undertaking was ordered exonerated shall be deemed prima facie evidence of exoneration or termination of the liability. And so I think there's some language from the legislature that says, well, we should have the right to rely on a minute order in certain circumstances. And I don't see why, when the city is treating these minute orders as being effective, why we shouldn't be able to as well. And I think to address another issue that the city is relying upon in this case, is they're saying, well, we don't meet the requirements of NRS 178.512. And that statute applies when you're trying to set aside a forfeiture that's been entered. Well, I submit to you that NRS 178.512 does not even apply when a forfeiture has been wrongly entered in the first place. And if a judge doesn't have authority to enter a forfeiture because the bond has already been exonerated, I don't think we ever even get to NRS 178.512. That statute's presuming that a lawful forfeiture has already been entered. And I think that's the position we take. We've taken that throughout this case, that NRS 178.512 doesn't carry the day. We're looking at a situation where the municipal court entered a forfeiture and then a judgment on a bond that had been exonerated. And I liken it to a breach of contract case where you get a breach of contract claim dismissed, and then you get the government trying to still get a judgment on a claim that's been dismissed. It just doesn't seem right to me. And I don't think there's authority for the court, legal authority for the court, to even do such a thing, Your Honors. So that's the basis of, you know, our argument today. And as for detrimental reliance, we looked at the minutes after we received the forfeiture two different times. We saw that the minutes say that the bond was exonerated. The city has never disputed that that's what the minutes say. We believe that the bond was exonerated, and we didn't pursue any of our legal remedies that we could have had if the bond hadn't been exonerated. One of those legal remedies would have been to file a motion to exonerate the bond under NRS 178.509, which says that you can have a bond exonerated when a defendant has reappeared after a bench warrant has been issued and there was a satisfactory excuse for his failure to appear. We never even filed such a motion because the minutes say the bond was exonerated, Your Honors. And so I believe that we do have detrimental reliance in this case. I think the city recognizes that the case law from Martinez and Tudhill actually recognized that detrimental reliance applies in a bond context. And unlike those cases where the courts found that there was no reliance or prejudice, I think in our case, we didn't assert our legal remedies that we could have had because the bond was already exonerated, at least we thought it was, according to the minutes. And we're prejudiced by the fact we're now being forced to pay a bond that we believe is already exonerated, and that has never even been set, there's been no exoneration set aside here or reinstatement, Your Honor. So that's the basis of our position today, and I will turn it over to the city.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Still?
Good morning, Your Honor. Dean Still representing the city of Las Vegas and respondents in this matter. I guess I'll, rather than go from my prepared comments, I think I'll try to address some of the issues that have been raised, not only by the court, but by counsel. First of all, I'd like to talk about the detrimental reliance argument. Certainly, the appellant argued that it relied on this one entry. And I think I want to walk us through this one entry, because based upon that one entry, they assumed, and assuming is not my word, that is the word that they used in the lower court record, we assumed that the bond was exonerated. The problem is when you review the actual printed minutes that they had in front of them, because this is all they did, once they got the notice of intent from the city, from the municipal court, the only thing in the record, they clearly admitted in the record, the only thing they did was press print on two separate occasions. The first occasion was on May 27th, 2008, and for reference, it's page 179 of the appellant's appendix. This is exactly what the bonding company saw when they printed out that record. I think that's what the court really needs to look at. What did they see, and what did they supposedly detrimentally rely on and assume what was in front of them?
Counsel, even though we have jurisprudence as to formal orders, my question, because of the argument, is whether or not this is the way business is done at the municipal court. As counsel has stated, there's minute orders that exonerate the bonds.
They do. In many instances, occasionally there are actual written orders. But the exception in this case is this is a clerk-entered minute, not based upon any documentation, not any order or action by the presiding judge that was overseeing this case. If you look at the entry, it says special assessment.
Well, since the municipal court seems to be operating in a manner other than by written order, what's the distinction between a clerk-entered order and a judge-entered order?
That's a fair enough question. And I think the distinction is this, Your Honor, that this particular entry only relates to a fee. The old system that we had was limited. It was antiquated and old. And you could only put in certain entries the way it was set up. This one entry that they're relying on was this a special assessment fee that the legislature authorized courts to collect, as I'm sure you're aware. And it's a $7 fee. It says special assessment fee, surety bond exonerated. At best, if they were going to detrimentally rely on that, they could detrimentally rely that the $7 special assessment fee had been exonerated. The problem is this. Subsequent to that entry, on the same page, there are additional entries that corroborate the notice of intent that was sent by the municipal court. More specifically, on May 8th, the continuance was granted. The notice of intent was sent out on May 8th, so they got it. A few days later, they hit print, this showed up, and it indicates and corroborates the November 18th, 2008 hearing was scheduled, and it says purpose, forfeiture bond. So then the next thing they did is they did nothing after that to, like, what does this mean? It's kind of confusing. They waited a few months and printed another printout on September 12th, and that's page 186 in the appendix. Again, there were six pages. There were two additional entries that corroborated the notice of intent that said, purpose of these hearings, that there's a June 25th, 2008 entry that indicates that hearing is still on for forfeiture, and there's an August 26th, 2008 entry, unable to locate defendant, purpose of the hearing on November 18th, bond forfeiture. So they're taking one entry, relying on it, and not looking at the totality of the document and reading it in context. As a matter of fact, in the underlying court, they admitted that they were confused. You know, it's hard for civilians, as I said, to read this stuff. But what did they do? And this is what Judge Tagliati found. They did nothing. They did nothing at all. Now, in fact, They had many options. I mean, they could have called our bond department. They could have called the bond attorney for the city that handles all these matters. They could have emailed us. They could have set something on calendar. When they got, when they printed this last notice, it was they still had over 60 days before the forfeiture hearing was on. They could have certainly made a phone call or made some kind of effort, put something on the calendar, grabbed the bond attorney in open court and say, hey, let's talk about this. Not a thing was done. Not a thing. And then they were surprised that the court went ahead with the forfeiture hearing that was on all the minutes that they were reading that conflicted with the one entry that they're relying on but was corroborated by the notice of intent. The notice of intent plus these entries keep telling them, I would say a reasonable mind, it keeps telling a reasonable mind, at worst, you know, there's something going on here and I need to look into it a little bit further. I can't just put on blinders, sit on my hands and do nothing and rely on one entry and ignore all the subsequent entries and actions taken by the municipal court. It's not, I don't think it's a commercially reasonable business practice for a bonding company. I mean, I'll let the court decide that, but it doesn't, just as a layperson outside looking in, if you have subsequent entries and a notice from a court, you look at an entry that had happened 3 months earlier and you hang your head on that, I would submit that is not reasonable. And I think Judge Togliatti made the same finding.
Is the matter ever resolved in municipal court between the defendant and the city?
Ultimately, yes. And there was an issue plead and I forgot. It was subsequent to the hearing in front of Judge Assad in January of 2009. I forgot the time frame, but it did get resolved, ultimately.
Do you think that has a bearing on this forfeiture situation?
No, not at all. I deal with these all the time in the municipal court. And 512 is the standard, the legislated standard in Nevada for bond forfeitures and to address bond forfeitures post-forfeiture. I mean, that is what the legislature has set forth.
But when the defendant did appear, I'm assuming he appeared without an attorney in municipal court, did anybody say anything to him about the bond?
Before or after he pled, Your Honor?
During that period of time when the case was being resolved? Because the minute order is before the case is resolved, right?
That's correct. That is correct.
So here a defendant appears before a municipal judge and the case is resolved. Did anybody mention anything at that time about the bond problem?
I read the record and I cannot represent to you that it was. Now, I didn't read the record of him appearing in court. That wasn't part of this record to pull that up because that was a separate hearing. But I can tell you this, that he was arrested in January of 2007. A warrant went out. That warrant was quashed. And he was released. And then a subsequent warrant was issued. And that's what generated what we're talking about here.
But then he did appear finally and the case was resolved.
Yes, long after Judge Assad had made this, it was working its way up through district court on the writ/appeal. Yeah. So the only other thing I'd like to bring to the court's attention is 178.512, because we get this argument a lot in municipal court. I've been doing these now. I've done bond law for a long time for the city, but not in municipal court. So I've been doing it about a year. But the one thing that the statute is very clear is the court shall not set aside the forfeiture. Shall not. This is a legislative mandate. Shall not set it aside unless some things happen. One, they make an application to set it aside. And they did that in this case. I don't know if counsel forgot that, but they actually did make an application in an attempt to exonerate the bond post-forfeiture. But once they've made the application, the court needs to make a specific finding, either that the defendant appeared and he and the court says, fine, they're here, we'll quash the warrant, the bond will remain. Or the defendant is dead, he's ill, he's deported, or he's detained. In this case, there's not a scintilla of evidence that any of that Judge Assad could make that finding. He couldn't because there was no evidence to support it.
And was the case resolved at the time they tried to reinstate the bond?
No.
So he was still at large?
Yes. Yeah. The warrant was still out at that time. And what's interesting, it's an interesting question because By this time, by November 18th, right after November 18th, the notice of entry of the order of judgment was sent to the bonding company, and that's what got their attention, apparently, for the third time, that, oh, wow. So they came in to deal with that issue, and these arguments were had on 512, and, you know, Judge Assad made his ruling. But the one thing that they had is they had an initial 60 days to go find the defendant, and there's not a scintilla. There's nothing in the record to indicate that they even tried to go look for him.
Did the bonding company come in after the case was resolved at any time to try to reinstate the bond in municipal court? After the defendant took care of the case, did the bonding company then come in and say, wait a minute, there's a terrible mistake here?
I can't say yes or no because I defer to them. My instinct is no, but I really don't have anything to back that up with.
Awesome. Mr. Flynn, gets back up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Flynn, you want to try to answer that? I see that you tried to go in before the case was resolved, but did the bonding company try to go in after the case was resolved?
Your Honor, the problem our client has is that when cases are resolved, they're usually criminal sentencing matters, and we don't get notice of those hearings. And so we'd have to constantly check the docket for a case that has been outstanding for 6 years to constantly find out when the hearing would be. And I've actually showed up at one of those hearings before, and they don't get resolved, and then you don't even know if they're going to show up the next time because they continue the hearing for whatever reason. So unless we get notice of it, it's really difficult for us to find out when the case is actually going to get resolved, Your Honor. But I think to clarify the facts in this case, what happened when the minutes show the bond was exonerated in this case, it was in February of 2008 when the defendant actually showed up to quash his bench warrant, and the bench warrant was satisfied. So the defendant actually did show up in court and got his bench warrant quashed, and the bond was, according to the minutes, exonerated at that time. And that's a pretty traditional procedure where a bond actually will be exonerated when a defendant reappears after a bench warrant has been issued. And then usually what the court does is they make him post a new bond with a new bond company. That didn't happen here. And in essence, what the city is trying to say is, well, you know, the minute order may have said that, so when he failed to appear again, we're just going to hold you on the hook for that bond again. And that just seems unjust to me. I mean, they're basically reinstating the bond without ever doing the motion to reinstate it, even though the case law that they rely upon says that that's the proper procedure to do.
Mr. Flynn, I'm confused. When did the defendant appear?
Your Honor, it was on February 6, 2008, and if you look at the record, from page 16 to 17, and it shows on February 26, 2008, it says bench warrant satisfied, paid on the top of page 17, and then about four lines down from that, it says surety bond exonerated. And in fact, on page 16, the last entry says motion granted because I believe it was a motion quashed, which is a traditional thing when you have a bench warrant outstanding, the defendant files a motion to quash, and then the bench warrant is then cleared when the motion is granted, and oftentimes the defendant posts a new bond.
The defendant didn't stop by the office to say, by the way, I know there's a bench warrant out for me, I'm going to go take care of the case.
That actually doesn't happen a lot, Your Honor.
I know, I represent a lot of people like that.
And, Your Honor, it's a minute order issue. I just want to make another point here, which is that if the minute order exonerating the bond isn't going to be determined to be effective, well, then what do we do with the forfeiture that was entered via minute order? I mean, if that's how the forfeiture was entered, I mean, that's how they're always entered in municipal court. They send out a notice of forfeiture, and they're entered via a minute order the day usually that it says it will be forfeited, that day. Well, that's exactly what happened here. So we have a minute entry that says the bond was exonerated, and then we have a minute entry that says there was a forfeiture, and the city's relying upon the forfeiture for that minute entry, but it seems unjust that we can't rely on the minute order that says the bond was exonerated. And then another point, Ron, is that after...
Perhaps if people followed the jurisprudence on this subject, there would be written orders, and the confusion that both of you are arguing about wouldn't exist.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think maybe, you know, it would be best in the future to do everything by written order, and it would be nice if there was a case law that required that, because I know that, you know, a lot of times we show up to hearings for a motion to exonerate, for example, in the city, and it's already been exonerated by the time we get there. And so we don't even have time to submit an order because the bond's already been exonerated pursuant to a written order, and since that was traditionally the way written orders and bond exoneration motions were granted, we wouldn't then submit another order. We just thought that the order was already conclusive. But Your Honors, what happened is after the, or at the hearing, before the municipal court, setting aside the forfeiture, Judge Assad, who was a municipal court judge at the time hearing the matter, he confirmed with the city that this is what the written order says it says. And nobody at that time tried to say, well, it's incorrect, it shouldn't have been exonerated because there were no grounds for exoneration. That just didn't happen. I mean, the argument was, we don't meet the requirements of NRS 178.512, and we're filing our motion to set aside the forfeiture late. Well, they had an opportunity at that time to try to reinstate the bond, or even argue why the bond was improperly exonerated, and they haven't done either of those in this case, Your Honor. They've never even articulated a reason why the bond was improperly exonerated. To me, it's a standing order of exoneration, the way things have always been done, and now they're trying to have a bond forfeited, notwithstanding the fact that it has been exonerated. I see my time is up, Your Honors. Thank you.
Okay, we appreciate counsel's arguments in this case and your briefing, and the matter will stand submitted.